So on the wiki page, the title of my talk is Heterogeneous Beta-Lactam Resistance, a little known but potentially huge problem. That is the provocative title. It's accurate, but the more descriptive title is Heterogeneous Beta-Lactam Resistance is widespread and is mediated by an active starvation response. So to motivate you to listen to me for 90 minutes, even during the most tedious parts of the talk, I've decided to give you a very quick overview of our results. Rather than spoil the surprise, I think they will captivate your attention. So I'll be making some bold claims, and you'll want to see the proof. So today I'm going to talk about this phenomenon called heterogeneous beta-lactam resistance, or HBLR. And you will need to remember this acronym, HBLR. I'll be using it throughout my talk. If you don't remember it, you will be lost. And so in HBLR, resistors occur at extraordinary frequencies, as high as 1 in 10 to the 2. HBLR has been studied mostly in vitro. It's difficult to detect by conventional diagnostics tools. It's largely been assumed to be unique to the staphylococci, and it has a poorly understood mechanism. So I'm going to present to you data that shows that HBLR likely occurs in vivo. It's not just in the staphylococci, but rather is widespread in the bacterial kingdom, and so may be far worse of a problem than previously realized. And it's mediated by a mechanism that is the same or similar in extremely diverse species. Our data raise the specter that HBLR may be causing many treatment failures and deaths worldwide, unbeknownst to clinicians. So according to some back-of-the-envelope calculations I did, I reckon that HBLR could be responsible for tens of millions of treatment failures and hundreds of thousands of deaths worldwide per year. So in the first part of my talk, I'm going to give you a review of HBLR in MRSA so that you know what the phenomenon is and that you are aware of some of its more bizarre characteristics. And the second part of my talk, I will present to you our soon-to-be-published findings. So let me begin with the review. So what I'm about to tell you in the review has been well established. So HBLR was discovered in the 1960s in MRSA. Most MRSA strains, the overwhelming majority, exhibit HBLR. There are on the order of 100 papers documenting this. Nevertheless, in my experience, some people have trouble believing me when I first discuss these things. So we're going to be concerned about MECA-mediated resistance in MRSA. And for those of you who don't know what that is, I will give you a brief overview. So the beta-lactams are a very important class of antibiotics. They're one of the largest, most effective, safest, and hence most commonly prescribed classes. In 2003, which is the statistic that I'm most familiar with, beta-lactams accounted for 65% of the total world market for dosage form sales of antibiotics. So virtually all bacteria, although not all, but virtually all, produce penicillin-binding proteins, or PBPs. And these PBPs are anchored to the cell membrane and reside in the space between the cell membrane and cell wall, and they help to synthesize the cell wall. Beta-lactams bind to these PBPs and thereby inhibit them and thereby inhibit cell wall synthesis. This usually...
Does it tend to attack all of the PBPs or just...
No. Different beta-lactams have different binding affinities. And not all PBPs are essential. And some of the non-essential PBPs become essential when other PBPs are inhibited. So there's actually an extraordinary amount of combinatorial complexity. And that explains the wildly different MICs for beta-lactams. But so usually this is accompanied by cell death, and usually this is accompanied by lysis. So you have the whole scale degradation of the cell wall, and then the membrane bursts due to osmotic pressure. Now, there's a great deal of debate in the community as to whether or not the lysis actually causes the death, or if it occurs after the fact. And indeed, the prevailing wisdom now is that the lysis occurs after the fact. So even though we discovered penicillin in 1929, we still don't exactly understand how it works. And for a good review, see this link. Or have a gene called MECA. And MECA codes for a very special PDP called PDP2A. And this PDP has low binding affinity to beta-lactams. Even in the presence of beta-lactams, it can continue to synthesize the cell wall. And so for those of you who are familiar with MRSA, you're probably familiar with what I've already said. But you may not be familiar with what comes next. So, MECA. So, MECA is necessary for high resistance. Without MECA, typically all the cells are susceptible or borderline susceptible, as shown here. So, in all beta-lactams. So one thing that is important is to distinguish this between from beta-lactamase-mediated resistance, which involves an enzyme that cleaves beta-lactams. Oh, so in the staphylococci, we use beta-lactams that are resistant to beta-lactamase cleavage. So they include methicillin, oxacillin, nafacillin, many of the C-plus forms. So a very wide range. And this is true for all of those, okay? The ones that are resistant to beta-lactamase cleavage. It's a rather general phenomenon in MRSA. So the population here is homogeneously susceptible. What many people don't know is that MECA is not sufficient for high resistance. Even with MECA, typically most of the cells are still susceptible or borderline susceptible, with only a fraction between 1 in 10 to the 5 to 1 in 10 to 2 being highly resistant. So in other words, the population is heterogeneously resistant.
So this is a genetically identical population, or that is
so if you take a colony of the strain and you grow it up into mid-exponential phase, this is what you'll see. So it's a clonal population. Yeah.
Yes, but the ones that are resistant have mutations, and
I'll get to that.
And they maintain their resistance, so it's
yes.
High frequency of mutations.
Yes. So both the susceptible and resistant cells express the same levels of MECA. So it seems that resistance is due to MECA plus some unknown factor X. And despite decades of research, X has remained mysterious. So HBR should not be confused with persistence or tolerance. So the resistors replicate in the presence of the antibiotic, and the trait is heritable over many generations. Hence, the resistors are neither persistors nor tolerators. And to avoid some ambiguity, I'm going to define these terms. And there's no widely accepted definition for these terms, so these are my definitions. You may disagree with them, but going forward, we need some set of definitions. So a resistor replicates in the presence of the antibiotic, and the trait is heritable. A persistor survives, but cannot replicate in the presence of the antibiotic, and the trait is not heritable. And a tolerator survives, but cannot replicate in the presence of the antibiotic, and the trait is heritable. Okay, so these are the definitions that I'm going to use. So the frequency of resistors is remarkable. People have tried to understand the frequency, and there's been no really banal explanation. So the resistors occur at frequencies as high as 1 in 10 to the 2. And to be precise, this is the frequency of resistors that's observed in a culture after inoculating the culture with a single colony and growing to, say, mid-exponential phase.
Sorry, Can you go back one slide again?
Sure.
I figure it's really important to get this information.
Okay. These definitions?
Yeah.
So we tolerate it, but we can't replicate. How is it preheritable?
So once the antibiotic is removed, it grows up, and the entire population in the next iteration can survive the antibiotic therapy. Whereas the persister, it's stochastic. Some will survive, some will not.
Some would argue that that's not, like you said, that's your definition.
Yeah, I don't think there is a universal definition. But let's talk about that after, because that's a can of worms.
Michael, there's one line missing, which is the replicating the presence of antibiotic, but not being heritable. But is that's so just phenotypic?
Yeah. I haven't enumerated all possibilities. That's true. These are just some terms, but yes. So yeah, this frequency is truly remarkable. So for comparison, resistors to the RNA polymerase inhibitor rifampicin curve frequencies of like 1 in 10 to the 8 to 1 in 10 to the 9. These resistors appear to be caused by spontaneous mutations in the native chromosome. They do not appear to be due to lateral gene transfer. Indeed, the cultures are monolithic. They do not appear to be mutations in a high copy number plasmid or due to hypermutators, or due to hot spots for mutation in the genome.
Is it excluded that there are duplications of parts of the genome that arise by recombination between insertion elements? Because that seems the only thing you could ever get a frequency approaching the one.
So I will explain to you what the mechanism is, but a priori was not known. It was anyone's guess what was going on.
Is it always 1 in 10 to 2? Because if it's just a spontaneous mutation, it should be broad.
It varies between 1 in 10 to the 5 to 1 in 10 to the 2, depending on the species and the strain.
So in a given species and strain, it's always pretty consistent?
It's almost completely reproducible, although there's some stochastic variability.
And we're here focusing on MECA carrying Staph aureus.
Yes.
Because there's no statistics like this for other species, and the numbers might vary.
Yes.
So what do you mean with over many generations?
You can passage the cells repeatedly through, say, 3/9 cultures, and the resistance will be true. Hundreds of generations.
So can I ask you, these resistors that you're going to explain this are the ones that resist to high levels?
Pardon me?
These resistors that you are referring to are the ones that resist to very high levels.
Yeah, I will show that.
All the others, you're not going to talk about.
I'll show you a whole curve in a moment. Yeah, it's part of the review.
So, but the others are not heritable.
I'll show you a curve. I'll get to it in a moment. So because MECA is found almost exclusively in MRSA and other Staph and cocci, it's been largely assumed that HBR is unique to the genus. And so in my experience, HBR remains a little known phenomenon, except amongst certain circles of staphylococci experts. So let me tell you a few.
The last slide may not have been politically correct. The women and the expert was a man.
Oh, I didn't see that. I apologize for that. There was nothing meant to be insinuated by that. Don't read into that. So let me tell you a few of the other features of HBLR. So the resistors always have a reduced growth rate. And so that's shown here by this illustration. So in the absence of antibiotic, the wild type cells will have a certain doubling time. And the resistors will have a certain doubling time, which often is only about 10 or 20% longer. And then in the presence of super MIC concentrations of an antibiotic, the wild type cells, of course, do not grow. In fact, they lyse. And the resistors will grow, although sometimes very slowly. So the antibiotic has an effect in that it can slow growth, but not halt it.
And if you continuously vary from none to super MEC, where's the trade-off?
I'm going to show you the curve.
And Michael, but what are the genetics here? The wild type is
Just a wild-type MRSA strain?
It's a wild-type MRSA
strain. And the resistors are?
Mutant.
Presumably mutant. Another, perhaps one of the oddest features of HBR is that it very strongly depends on environment.
I feel terrible to keep interrupting, but if the resistors are popping up at such a high frequency, how do you do that assay?
I will get to the there's a whole method to detecting this called PAP.
Patient.
So one of the oddest features of HBLR is that it very strongly depends on environment. So by changing any one of a myriad of environmental variables, you can make the wild-type cells behave as if they're resistors, so that the entire population is homogeneously resistant. Or you can make the resistors behave like wild-type cells so that the entire population is homogeneously susceptible. So let me elaborate on that. So when you pick a colony of a strain and you grow it up in culture, typically what you see is heterogeneous resistance. That is, the resistors occur at frequencies of 1 in 10 to the 5 to 1 in 10 to the 2. However, you could imagine that what you could see would be homogeneous resistance, where the resistant cells occur at very high frequencies, or homogeneous susceptibility, where they occur at extremely low frequencies. And so you can modify many environmental variables and switch between these phenotypes. So by, say, lowering the temperature or adding sodium chloride to the medium, you can go from heterotypic resistance to homotypic resistance. By raising the temperature, adding magnesium ions, increasing light intensity, or increasing oxygen levels, you can go from heterogeneous resistance to homogeneous susceptibility. The studies with oxygen date back to the 1960s, long before Collins' work on reactive oxygen species and oxidative stress responses. And these changes are completely reversible. So if you change the environmental variables back, the phenotype goes back.
How about other divalent metal ions?
It's a long, long list.
Let's say like manganese. It's
so the middle is anaerobic in the middle one?
So if you add oxygen, you go from here to here. And if you take away oxygen, we found you can go from here to here.
Take away meaning which
grow it anaerobically.
Okay. But the middle one, the one you're telling me initially.
Yeah, the middle one is the most common under most common conditions.
But they're aerobic.
Usually growing aerobic.
Okay. And so to go to the left, you're adding more oxygen.
Yep. And to go to the right, you can add less, or you can take away oxygen. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think these conditions change the binding affinity?
Not known. So despite decades of research, HBR's strong dependence on environmental conditions is not understood. Because HBR is studied in vitro and depends strongly on environmental conditions, it's unclear if it exists in vivo. It could be a laboratory phenomenon and the clinicians don't have to care about. Clinicians avoid the use of beta-lactams to treat MRSA infections because they know the drugs are ineffective from experience. But this could be because the cells are heterogeneously resistant in vivo, or the cells are homogeneously resistant in vivo. And this distinction is important. If beta-lactams kill the overwhelming majority of cells, then they might still be very effective when used in combination with other types of antibiotics.
Can you actually reduce the effective density of infecting cells using a beta-lactamase that is, so oxacillin on an infection? Do you see in a clinical setting any reductions in bacterial load?
So people don't do these experiments in clinical settings, but I will show you something similar in a well-established model of infection.
In mouse.
I'll describe the model. It's actually a model of endocarditis. Okay. So now I'll get to the curves that you've been asking about. Okay?
You're talking about the MECA background, right?
Now, MECA, for now I am.
MECA confers resistance to beta-lactam that would bind to PBP2, right?
No. PBP2 is an essential PBP, but MECA confers resistance to the entire class of beta-lactams. except for the super beta lactams that have been recently marketed. So it's a broad resistance. It's not specific to any particular beta lactam. That's why MRSA became infamous. So the best way to detect HBR is to do something called a population analysis profiling, or PAP. Okay, so I'm going to sort of describe to you the process, and I think this will answer many of your questions. So I'm going to go through it kind of step by step, because it's really important. But anyway, so first what you do, usually, is you take an inoculating loop, you streak out the stalk, and then you incubate the plate to get individual colonies. And so this animation shows that.
Oh, you do it that way?
So next, you pick a single colony and use it to inoculate a culture, and then you grow it up, sometimes overnight, sometimes in the mid-exponential phase. And so it's really important to do this because you want your cultures to be maximally genetically homogeneous. And because you pick a colony, you want to do biological replicates so that you make sure that what you're seeing is not a peculiarity of the colony. In fact, we also do biological replicates by taking stalks of the same strain from different centers to make sure that what we're seeing is not a peculiarity of the stalk that we're working with. And then once you have your overnight culture, you prepare a series of dilutions. And for each dilution, you plate on progressively higher and higher concentrations of some antibiotic. You incubate, usually up to 72 hours. And depending on the density of cells that you get, that you plate, and the concentration of the antibiotic, you get different types of growth. And so then you can tabulate the colony counts. And based on this, you can compute a PAP curve. And so this is a plot of a fraction of the CFUs that grew into visible colonies as a function of the antibiotic concentration on the plate. And this is the curve I was referring to.
The conventional MYC on there is red.
As you can see, a MYC means nothing.
No, but the conventional.
And it's hard to kind of tie that with E-test and Roth dilution, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So, although actually, the next slide does sort of allude to what you asked. So, the MYC, you know, doesn't really mean anything. So in my lab, to kind of get around that, we introduced what's called the MYC PAPX, which is defined as the minimum concentration tested that inhibits greater than X percent of the CFUs. So the MYC PAP 90 would be the concentration that inhibits the growth of 90% of the CFUs, so you'd see a tenfold drop.
And you can reproduce this for each strain.
So for each strain, each antibiotic, this curve is highly reproducible with some stochastic variability.
And the density effect on MICs is accounted for in your plating.
So there. Usually there's no density effect. So meaning that, I'm not actually sure what you mean by density effect. Okay.
Are you doing this experiment? How do you know the number of CFUs if they don't grow into a visible colony?
Oh, so you know how much you get on no antibiotic, and that tells you how many CFUs per milliliter there are in the overnight culture, and then you see how many you get on antibiotic, and then you can do the calculation.
How long do you incubate the plate?
For up to 72 hours, although usually the PAP will stabilize at 24 hours, but at very high concentration of antibiotic, it can take longer than 24 hours to see the visible colony.
Do you think the colonies that grow up on the plate at 1 mg/mL are genetically different from the ones that grow up on 4 mg/mL?
I will address
the plating efficiency.
I will address that. So for reference, this is the CSI breakpoint for clinical resistance. It doesn't mean much for reasons that will become evident later on. But you can see that the majority of cells will be classified as clinically susceptible, and the minority of cells will be classified as clinically resistant. And these resistors are not persisters. So you can pick a colony growing on antibiotic, and you can use that to inoculate a culture, grow it up, and do another PAP, and this is the PAP curve that you get. And I think to answer your question, well, we actually did sequencing, but to answer your question, you can pick basically anywhere along the curve, and this is true, usually, even at twofold above the MIC.
I guess I'm not sure that means they're not persisters. I mean, you're taking them, you're doing something to them, you're changing them, they switch back to not being persisters and so on.
Oh, so you pick a colony from the plate that grew up on the antibiotic. Right. You inoculate a culture, you grow it up in the absence of antibiotic, and then you repeat the PAP, usually first.
I understand the protocol, but I thought the definition of persisters was that it wasn't a genetic change.
Yeah, and the this shows it is a genetic change.
They're much more resistant. The red guys are
Much more. The population is homogeneously resistant.
Oh, sorry, okay, so, okay.
They're not persisters.
They could be persistent as well, but they're, that's an
extreme. I think they're definitely not.
Yeah. So you better beat them, say, the same guy again and again.
Mm-hmm.
The red curve goes down, or is it the same?
Yeah, there seems to be some maximal value at which everything dies, and it's very hard to get above that. So,
and if you pick them lower, it will also go down faster?
Well, so if you pick it here, the PAP curve might be more like this.
Okay.
If you pick it here, it's more like this. But yeah, so there's some correlation between the concentration you pick at and how homogeneously resistant the resulting culture is. Although it's not as strong as you might think.
Just to get it right, so if you pick this colony and you inoculate again and you have 100% or something mm-hmm. like that resistant, and you now change the environment,
mm-hmm.
they're still 100%? Or
no, if you increase the temperature, they will suddenly collapse and become heteroresistant or homosusceptible.
How much temperature do you need?
So usually the experiments are 37 degrees to... if it's a collapse resistance, 37 degrees to 42. Yeah.
How can you have fractions bigger than one?
Oh, because there's some stochastic variability, so
yeah.
The number, yeah, you see? Did I answer your question? Do you want me to explain it? Flesh it out. So sometimes on zero, you'll get 180 colonies. Sometimes on 0.30, you'll get 190 colonies. And that is mostly just experimental error and also sampling error, you know, which would be, I think, Poisson distributed. Yeah.
So the resistance you're collecting here are not necessarily these high level resistant ones, because you're only doing it like double the MIC. So some of the resistance you'll get would be just the nitrogen.
So we select through the entire curve, and the resistance breeds true, and the mutations don't map to MEK-A. They don't seem to have anything to do with MEK-A.
But as in, I thought you had to put the concentration at really high in order for you to be homogeneous resistance of this. This MEK-A plus X.
No, so if you pick here,
yeah.
These all have MEK-A.
Yeah.
They're all expressing MEK-A at comparable levels. But if you pick here, the resistance will breed true. You'll get a PAP that maybe looks something like this. If you pick here, you'll get a PAP that looks more homogeneously resistant. And if you pick here, you'll get one that's maybe straight out.
So if you look at
but it's not necessarily to do with MEK-A. MEK-A
if you look at the colony growth,
mm-hmm.
then you should, if there are big changes across the red. The red curves on the top, the common growth rates?
The growth rate can be affected by the concentration of the antibiotic. They can grow slower, but they will grow.
And is that not a huge effect?
It varies depending on the strain, but sometimes not much.
I have a question. I really want to know what is X label.
Okay. So PAP is the most reliable way to detect HBLR. So currently PAP is too work intensive to be done in the clinic. And conventional methods like E-test and broth dilution can miss HBLR. So if you're using these methods to measure resistance, then you might be working with a heterogeneously resistant strain and never know it. And I don't think I can go into detail about this, but I think conceptually it's easy to understand. These tests give you a single MIC. But with heteroresistance, the cells have many different MICs. And so the single MIC could reflect the wild-type cells, or the resistors, or be somewhere along that continuum. And when clinicians make decisions based on that MIC, they can make the wrong treatment decisions, and that can lead to treatment failures and deaths.
Mm-hmm. Can you ask you that, because we heard that the talk previously was where they measured MIC with the same method, actually, is that the MIC that would be measured in the regular lab would be very dependent on the inoculant. Right. If you inoculate cells where the probability of getting the resistance is is very low, then you would measure a low MIC. If you inflate more cells, you'll get a higher MIC. Is it true?
That is true. Actually, it depends on many things. And I actually have some slides that go through that, but unless people really want to see the gory details, I'm going to skip them. Okay? So let me skip them. So this shows why E-test fails. This shows why broth dilution fails. And let me restart here. So failure to detect heterogeneous resistance can lead to poor treatment decisions and hence treatment failures and even death. So if the broth dilution MIC represents the wild type cells the clinician may decide to treat, not knowing there's a resistant subpopulation that can compromise therapy. If the MIC represents the resistors, the clinician may conclude that the antibiotic is useless, not knowing that it kills a vast majority of cells, and so may be very effective when used in combination with another antibiotic.
If you take the cells that you see are having a strong resistance, the guys from your red curve, mm-hmm. are they still as resistant in liquid culture?
Usually, but environment is important. In fact, it is almost meaningless to talk about resistance without first stating the growth conditions that you're using. So standard institutes like the CSI and UCAST have gone to great lengths to deal with HBR and the staphylococci. So it was discovered in the 1960s, and for decades they've refined the protocols. They've changed the growth conditions, they kept lowering the MIC. And sometimes you'll see they'll just lower the MIC. And you might think they're mad, but they actually are more intelligent than a lot of laboratory people give them credit for. And so if you ever do an E-test or a broth dilution for a suspected MRSA isolate, for say a beta-lactam like oxacillin, you will see that the CSI and UCAS say you need to add salt to the growth medium to 2% weight per volume, and you need to drop the temperature from the standard 37 degrees to 35 or even lower. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to use these changes in environmental conditions to convert a strain from heterotypic to homotypic resistance to accentuate the resistance problem so that it becomes evident in the E-test and the broth dilution tests. And this is really important. When they didn't do this, clinicians would make the wrong treatment decisions and people died. Okay? This is a matter of life and death. It is. No such precautions are taken with the non-staphylococci because it is assumed that HBR does not occur in the non-staphylococci. Remarkably, no one has even bothered to test this assumption. So for some of you who want a precise definition of heterogeneous resistance, I included in my slides, but I'm not going to go through it. There is no agreed upon definition. The modus operandi has been, I know it when I see it. But this is my exact definition. And if you want to see it, you can sort of go through it in your own time.
Wait, you want to see it?
You want to see it? Oh, I was hoping you didn't want to see it.
You don't have to read it to us.
Somewhat tedious and pedantic, but I think it's correct.
Why 0.5 is the high
enough? Do the spontaneous mutations include duplication?
It could, as long as it's the native chromosome. Although it turns out it's not duplication.
So when we have our students do plate different dilutions, mm-hmm. on antibiotic-containing plates, and they catch one or two stragglers here and there, mm-hmm. And you make them go in and re-screen and test every one of these and look at the MIC again, mm-hmm. and they think we're being assholes. We tend not to see this extreme effect with most of the lab strains we work with.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about what are you this MRSA?
We're talking about, well, starting with Newman, PS80, these classical non-MRSA strains.
Okay, so with MRSA you don't really, or MSA you don't really see it, because it you need back in.
So then when you talk about this clinical burden, mm-hmm. You're drawing this long, it's this big conclusion about all staphylococci.
But it's all MRSA, and that is...
Yeah, but there's MEC-8, there's MEC typing is what I'm implying, and you usually don't dose with a penicillin or oxacillin when you know you have a MEC cassette present.
Sure.
So it's the actual clinical burden might be overstated slightly.
Let me get to that. I will show you a simulation of a treatment. So I'm done with the review, and I'm just going to give you a summary of some of the key points that you should remember going forward. So because HBLR has been studied in vitro and depends strongly on environmental conditions, it's unclear if it exists in vivo. It has been largely assumed that HBR is unique to the staphylococci. The mechanism of HBR is poorly understood, and the frequency of resistors, which is in this range, is remarkable.
And that frequency of resistors is the elevation of that plateau in the PAP plot.
Yeah. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to part two. And the way I've structured part two is I'm going to first state your finding, and then I'm going to provide to you the supporting data. So our first finding is that HBR likely occurs in vivo and is a source of treatment failures. And maybe this will address some of your questions. So to prove that, we considered a type of bacterial infection called endocarditis. So this is a relatively common type of infection in intensive care units. It's very serious. It can kill you within 24 hours. And bacterial endocarditis involves bacteria attaching to the heart, usually a valve. And the resulting inflammation leads to a prototypic lesion called the vegetation that is a mass of bacteria, platelets, fibrin, and scant inflammatory cells. And so this picture here shows four vegetations in a heart valve. And these vegetations are very dangerous. They can grow and interfere with the function of the heart and cause cardiac arrest. They can break off and establish secondary site infections, or they can break off and lodge in the circulatory system and cause a clot or a stroke. And from our perspective, not necessarily the clinician's perspective, but from our perspective, endocarditis is a relatively simple system. Because heart valves don't have a dedicated blood supply, they can't mount much of an immune response. And so people talk about these endocarditis vegetations existing in the absence or in an immunofree zone. And because the heart is relatively sterile, there's no presence of commensals, and so there's no interspecies competition. So we considered a very well-established PKPD model that has been validated against a rabbit model. And so they did a lot of tests in this PK/PD model, they did a lot of tests in the rabbit model, and they compared the results, and they nearly overlapped identically.
What
does PK/PD stand for? Pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic, is that? Someone knows this. Is that it? Or? So we used this model. And the advantage of this model over rabbit model is you can sample at many time points and understand the temporal dynamics of evolution. Whereas the rabbit model, you have to sacrifice every time point. So this model involves constructing simulated endocarditis vegetations from real human tissue in the laboratory, inoculating with bacteria to realistic density of 5 × 10^6 CFUs per gram of sev, and placing them in heart-like units. And there are many of them in the heart-like unit. So, and we usually have multiple heart-like units, so we have many technical and biological replicates.
So this is always MRSA, or this is many bacteria?
So I'm going to show it for MRSA, and then the next finding will be it's true for many species.
What makes this unit heart-like?
Shaped like a heart? I don't know. Let me just say this. It's been validated against the rabbit model.
You simulate the same flow rates as you'd expect in pressures.
So we simulate the flow rates, and we also simulate realistic oxacillin treatment. So in the clinic, they administer oxacillin intravenously every 4 hours. The peak concentrations are usually, or plasma concentrations are usually 200 milligrams a liter, and there's a half-life about every half hour. And so you see these very strong oscillations, and we simulate.
So I mean, based on things you said before about oxygen and general lack of knowledge, one might think that the crucial thing was going to be the oxygen here. And is that known what it is in the heart-like conditions?
No, it was, I think, really thought about it. So.
Sounds really crucial, huh?
It could be, yeah. Could be. So this is a PAP for MRSA USA 300 for oxacillin. MRSA USA 300 is arguably the most important community-acquired MRSA strain, at least in the USA. And oxacillin is the standard beta-lactane used to treat staphylococci infections, except, of course, not MRSA. And you can see that at very low concentrations, 100% of the cells survive, and at very high concentrations, about 1 in 10 to the 4 survive. Now let's see if that would happen in vivo by looking at our PK/PD. So this shows simulated oxacillin treatment of MRSA USA 300 endocarditis. So at time equals 0, the density is about 5 times 10 to 6 CFUs per gram of SEV. Within 8 hours of treatment, most of those CFUs are killed. In fact, only about 1 in 10 to the 4 survive. And then they grow up to very high densities despite continued treatment, indicating that they are not persisters or tolerators.
Why is the end rate higher than the beginning? You don't allow it to reach maximum.
Yeah, because this is usually when endocarditis would become noticeable in a clinical setting and they would start treating.
Mike, in these systems, there's a strong selection for wall adhesion. And I've shown in an earlier paper that you have a residual population that seeds into this. Mm-hmm. But what I'm curious about is whether or not you don't see in your replicates the oscillation of these populations sometimes, where you have a bolus injection, or is this a continuous infusion of oxacillin within this setup?
Well, we're oscillating. We're varying oxacillin to capture the oscillations that would be seen in a real patient. So it's this curve here, yeah. Right? Yeah. This is the way oxacillin is varying.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
If you eliminate the fluctuation in the environment and just treat it with some constant concentration, like you did in the test itself on the plates, how different the result would be?
Don't know, never done it, because that's not clinically how it's done. So here we wanted to capture what goes on in the clinic.
But you do have cases where you actually have a continuous infusion for in ICU.
I think with oxacillin you do not.
You don't?
But I'm not a clinician, so there may be exceptions. Okay. I'm not very knowledgeable about that. Okay? So clinicians avoid using beta-lactams like oxacillin against MRSA infections. However, it appears that such beta-lactams can rapidly kill the vast majority of MRSA cells, and so may be effective when used with other combinations of antibiotics. And we actually found MRSA strains that exhibit high homogeneous resistance in vitro, but actually heterogeneous resistance in our PK/PD model, suggesting that heterogeneous resistance may be even more common in vivo than in vitro. But everything depends on growth conditions.
So in the previous result, how do you interpret the growth after 8 hours? Is that heterogeneous resistance?
So the beta-lactame kills the resistors, or kills the wild-type cells.
Yes.
The resistors remain, and then they happily grow up.
But then at the last time point at 72 hours, you take 10 colonies out and you test them and show that they're resistant now?
We did, yeah. And we also prepared frozen stocks for further characterization and also whole genome sequencing.
But sorry, what is the dosage that you're using here? And how do
it's this curve. This is the dosage. This is what happens in a patient.
200 milligrams per liter.
Peaks at 200 milligrams per liter with a half-life of 0.5 hours.
That's your bolus injection.
How much more do you have by?
Quite a bit. So let's move on. So the next thing that we notice is that HBLR is very widespread in the bacterial kingdom. So we decided to search for HBLR by doing PAPs. So in all cases, we made sure that what we were seeing was not a trait of the colony we picked or the stock that we had. And because there are only 24 hours in a day, we chose to work with historically important bacterial genera. We We chose to work with beta-lactams that were clinically relevant or standard and that were resistant to beta-lactamase cleavage so that the presence of the beta-lactamase was not a confounding factor. So we worked with these. So this is a PAP for some MRSA strain. This is already known. This is a PAP for Bacillus subtilis 168 and cefuroxime. So Bacillus subtilis is the model organism for gram-positive bacteria. And 168 is perhaps the best studied strain. Heterogeneous resistance I don't think has ever been reported in Bacillus subtilis, at least not the type that I'm referring to. And what you see is that it is very heterogeneously resistant. So at low concentrations, most of the cells survive. And then at very high concentrations, about 1 in 10 to the 2 survive. Resistors are occurring in frequencies of 1 in 100. So we saw similar results for other bacilli, laboratory and wild type.
These don't have MECA.
Nope. The assumption that it only happens with MECA is categorically wrong. This is a PAP curve for E. coli MG1655 and Messicillium. So E. coli is the model for gram-negative bacteria. Arguably, MG1655 is the most studied strain. And you can see, you get heterogeneous resistance. At low concentrations, most of the cells survive. At high concentrations, about 1 in 10 to the 5 survive. If you read the very earliest papers on Messicillium, there are reports of resistors occurring at frequencies of 1 in 10 to the 5, but they never did much to rule out that they weren't persisters or tolerators. And we see similar results for other Escherichia.
Those cells wouldn't count as resistance because they are around the MIC. The MIC of MG6055 is around here.
The MIC is about 0.5. This is 8. This is 64. Many fold higher. 128 fold higher. And this actually keeps going.
All these cases you checked that none of this is persistent, but it's interesting to multiply it up. And then
we pick the colonies. We confirmed that resistance breeds true. Now that rules out persisters. It doesn't rule out tolerators by our definition. It's possible that the heritable trait is that the cells can survive but not grow on the plate, and that they only grow up after the antibiotic has degraded. Okay, and we ruled that out though. We measured the half-life.
For these different points where sort of cycles to which you've taken them?
Yeah, we just picked them from plates. So
the four colors that you had on the next slide.
Oh, yeah. So this is wild type. And this is the different levels that they were picked. Two fold above the MIC, or the MIC PAP 90. Some intermediate concentration and the highest concentration that they grew at. So regardless of where they're picked along the continuum, resistance breeds true.
And this breeds true for as many generations forward as you've looked.
Yeah, which is about what we do is we passage through three overnight cultures.
It's very specific to this antibiotic, right?
So with MRSA, it's true about all beta-lactams. For Bacillus subtilis, we've really only checked cefuroxime, and for E. coli, we've only checked Messicillium, and it's just because there's not enough hours in the day.
But we know it doesn't happen
for Yeah, be soon. Yeah, and I could kind of explain to you why what I think is going on, but yeah, of course, let's go. And actually, I will talk about that. So anyway, so we've measured the half-life of the antibiotics, and these things are growing in the presence of the antibiotic. I have some movies of individual cells, if you really want to see them. Okay, you want to know what X is. So the assumption that HBR is largely unique to Staphylococcus cocci is completely wrong. We've rarely found it wherever we've looked. We've searched mostly the Staphylococci, bacilli, and Escherichiae. However, these genera are very, very different. They're gram-positive, gram-negative. They have different planes of cellular division. They have different complements of PBPs. So it's almost certainly widespread, perhaps even universal. We've noticed that HBR depends on the strain. So for Bacillus subtilis and cefuroxime, you get a high degree of heterosistence for 168, but not SMY. We also note that it depends on the beta-lactam. So for E. coli MG165, you get a high degree of heterosistence. For Messicillium, but not ampicillin. Right now, we're doing a more systematic study. We're looking at many pathogens and many beta-lactams. But what I can tell you is, if you look, you will find it. There's this verse in the Bible, seek and she shall find. And all you have to do is look. The assumption that it's specific to staphylococci is categorically wrong.
I'm still curious about the experimental methodology.
Sure, maybe we'll get it. We'll get into it afterwards. Okay, so we verified the resistors have reduced growth rates. We checked for cross resistance to other antibiotics, and they're rather specific to beta lactams. And now I'll try and tell you what X is. So HBR is mediated by an active starvation response that is the same or similar in extremely diverse bacteria. So all in all, we collected about 150 resistors from the PK/PD model, from PAP plates, from the staphylococci, bacilli, E. coli, and also streptococci, which I don't want to discuss. I don't want to discuss that. And so we sequenced their whole genomes. We sequenced the whole genomes of all 150 of them. And this table summarizes what we found. And I struggled to try and convey to you the information in this table. At first, I had a whole bunch of pie charts. It was like a complete mess. So I'm just going to kind of qualitatively describe to you this table. Don't even try and understand this table. Don't even try to understand this table. Let me just tell you, because it'll take you an hour to try to understand this table. So it appears that mutations in any one of about on the order of 100 loci can cause resistance.
But this is assuming that the mutations are the causal thing.
We verify.
You can put these mutations back in the strain.
We verify. So in the majority of resistors, only one mutation was found genome-wide. Okay, and historically, our false positive and false negative rate for polymorphism discovery is virtually zero. That's not only for point mutations, but also larger structural variants. Rarely did two resistors have the same mutation, even resistors from the same PAP plate. So even colonies growing on the same PAP plate carried different mutations. It appears that the mechanism of resistance is the same or similar in the diverse bacterial genre. The same types of loci are mutated in the very different species. It appears that the mechanism is the same in vivo and in vitro. The mutations that we got from the PK/PD model and that we got from the PAP plates were in the same sorts of genes. So what's going on in the clinic, what's going on in a petri dish seem to be related. There's no disconnect between the clinicians and the PhDs. It appears that the resistance is due to an active starvation response mediated by the alarm hormone PPGPP.
And you can show changes in PPGPP levels.
So most of the mutated loci are involved in amino acid utilization, other types of nutrient utilization, or PPGP synthesis. So we wanted to prove that it seemed that a starvation response mediated by PPGPP was underlying resistance. So we did a whole series of experiments. Okay.
Sorry, I just misunderstood the logic. So just because you find mutations in certain kinds of genes in a certain kind of pathway, it doesn't necessarily say that it's somehow mediated by that pathway mutation.
So if these mutations cause resistance, and there's a pattern amongst them that seems to fall on a pathway, it shows that that pathway mediates resistance, is the cause of resistance.
Mediates
resistance. So the mutations seem to be triggering the pathway, and that pathway is causing resistance.
Okay.
And I'm going to try and sort of show you by the experiments that we did. So one of the things we did were E-tests for beta-lactams in the presence of different agents. So one was no agent to establish a baseline. One was an amino acyl tRNA synthetase inhibitor to cause partial starvation of amino acid, which slowed but did not halt growth. Okay, but it slowed it. Okay? Another was chloramphenicol, which we use as a control to slow growth to show that resistance is not merely due to a reduced growth rate. It's more profound than that, okay? And so this shows the doubling times. So for MRSA USA 300, we did it for Subtilis and E. coli. And in no agents, about 20 minutes, and with the ATSI and chloramphenicol, it's about 50 minutes, okay? This shows the e-test results, okay? So actually, this is an illustration. We actually don't take photos. We actually just record values, and both the where the zone of exclusion meets the strip and also the number of colonies in the zone of exclusion. But this is an accurate illustration. So with no agent, you get a big zone of exclusion. With a sub-inhibitory concentration of the ATSI, it completely fills up. And with the chloramphenicol, you get a bigger zone of exclusion. So this indicates that partial amino acid starvation induces resistance.
How about if you use CCCP, for instance?
I don't even know what CCCP is.
Proton motor forces.
I never used it. Don't know.
Well, what I'm hinting at is that there are a number of other possibilities that you probably should exclude if you want to.
Other than amino acid starvation.
Exactly.
Perhaps.
And ATSI might have an effect on the way you do your MIC. And that is, it is known that the MIC for the E-test can vary from the disc diffusion and from the liquid culture.
So we see this result even with PAP. So I don't think it's a matter of technicalities. Okay. There is an increase in resistance, but it could be that the ATSI is doing something other than partial amino acid starvation. Could be. That we have not ruled out. Okay, so next we showed that the induction of resistance by partial amino acid starvation depends on PPGPP. And so basically we knocked out all the PPGPP synthetases, so that the cell was incapable of producing PPGPP. And what we found is that when you added the ATSI, even to sub-inhibitory concentrations, you didn't get induction of resistance. In fact, you got no growth. Okay? So yeah, if you partially starve the amino acid, a cell of amino acid, and it's incapable of producing PPGPP, it just dies. So I'm showing for Bacillus subtilis and E. coli. The data that for MRSA we're in the process of collecting, and so I don't feel very comfortable talking about it. It seems it's the same for MRSA, but we need to do more replicates. Yeah. So we also show that the high frequency of resistors depends on PPGPP. Okay? So the frequency of resistors drops by about 100-fold from wild type to the PPGP0 construct. And so we've established necessity now. It seems that PPGP is sort of necessary, and then we establish sufficiency. So we overproduced PPGPP. And so for subtilis here, you have a series of strains that produce more and more levels of PPGPP. And then for E. coli, you also have such a series, and you see that there is a concomitant increase in the level of resistance. Okay, so then we decided to start testing all sorts of genetic constructs. Most of these were just single gene knockouts from the appropriate knockout libraries available for MRSA, Bacillus subtilis, and E. coli. And for those of you who know E. coli, it's the Kao collection.
So my working model has been that somehow you're enriching for mutants that are happening all the time, and you're setting up a condition.
We're not enriching for them. They happen in the absence of selection.
It's not that by giving them this stressful condition, there are certain mutants that now do better in that condition, and those are the mutants that also help you against the antibiotic. That's my working model. You're saying that's wrong.
What I'm culminating to is that what's happening is that any one of many mutations in the chromosome can induce the synthesis of PPGPP. And that triggers some pathway that confers resistance. And we're in the process of mapping out that pathway, but we haven't figured it out.
It's all a problem with the numbers, right? So if I take a target, if you take hundreds of genes,
I'm gonna get to that. Maybe I should skip to that. Maybe now you kind of have a sense of what X is, so I won't go and belabor.
I guess I'm skeptical about that.
Okay, let's get to that. So we try to map out the pathway. We've kind of gone halfway. We still don't know the ultimate targets of the pathway, but let's skip that. Let's talk about the high frequency of the resistors being explained by this, okay? So let me do an order of magnitude calculation to convince you that the large mutational target space alone explains the high frequency of resistors, okay? So in a population of bacterial cells derived from one cell, about 10 to the minus 2 cells will have at least one mutation somewhere in its genome. And this follows from the normal mutation rate in bacteria, which is one mutation per genome per 300 replications. Do you agree with that?
No, you have many generations in your growth. So I would have said 10 to the minus 1.
I think it's more 10 to the minus 2. Yeah, okay. If it's 10 to the minus 1, it's even better for us. But let's say 10 to the minus 2. Let's be conservative. I think most of the mutations enter in later generations when you're founding from a single cell.
The complication is things like Bacillus subtilis, where the rate is 10 to the minus 2, because it now suggests that the target size is the whole gene, right. And that's the same thing that Daniel
said. I will explain that too. So for our whole genome sequencing of our resistors, we extrapolate the mutations at any one of about 10 to the 5 bases can cause resistance. So among the 100 resistors that we sequenced, there are about 50 unique loci, and the screen was nowhere near to exhaustion. And many mutations were frame shifts or premature stop codons that may have the same effect anywhere along the length of the gene. So if you can target many genes, and you can knock them out by having a frame shift at the beginning or in the middle, you have a very large mutational target space.
Okay? Yeah. So am I understanding correctly? You measure 50 and you multiply up and extrapolate to...
So we sequenced 150 resistors. Many of them had unique mutations. And amongst that 150, there were like 50 unique loci. But given that even colonies from the same plate carry mutations in different genes, you probably suspect it's at least on the order of 100 loci that you can mutate. Many of them are frame shifts or premature stop codons, which have the same effect, whether they occur in the beginning or the middle. So the first order approximation. Okay. So this means that 10 to the minus 1 mutations, or 10% of the mutations, cause resistance. So I told you the mutational target space is on the order of 10 to the 5. A bacterial genome is on the order of 10 to 6 base pairs, so roughly 10% of the mutations are going to cause resistance. Does anyone disagree with this math so far? Therefore, the frequency of resistors would be on the order of 10 to the minus 3. So, you know, that's just the product of the number of cells with at least one mutation in the genome and the fraction of mutations that cause resistance. So that's on the order of 10 to the minus 3. But as Andrew pointed out, how do you explain 10 to the minus 2? So in the cases of 10 to the minus 2, what we find is that the resistors actually occur at about 10 to the minus 3 in exponential phase, and then they increase tenfold in stationary phase. And when we first started out, we did most of our PAPs with overnight cultures. Now we actually look at time evolution. But yeah, when we first started out, we did most of our PAPs with overnight cultures, so they had an opportunity to reach stationary phase. And it seems that in some cases, these resistors have a fitness benefit in stationary phase. Makes sense, because they overproduce PPGPP. PPGPP mediates the transition into stationary phase, so they might have a fitness advantage.
They're not really replicating actively in stationary phase, it doesn't really matter.
We think that the others are dying off.
But I've looked at the death rate, and that doesn't really kick in until about...
When you say you looked at the death rate, which bacteria?
A wide variety of Staph aureus.
I'm talking about Bacillus subtilis. So in Staph aureus, it's very, very rare to get 10 to the minus 2. It's usually 10 to the minus 3. When we see 10 to the minus 2, it's usually the Bacilli.
So they might be sporulating at a different rate or something.
It could be. All I can say is that by PAP, the frequency increases tenfold in stationary phase. Beyond that, I can't really go into detail.
I still have some problems wrapping my head around this massive mutational target size. So it's really 10% of the genome associated with that pathway?
So let me tell you, yeah, what PPGB does. So in response to amino acid starvation, nutrient deprivation, and many other stresses, the cell overproduces PPGBP. Okay? And that triggers a whole regulatory cascade that results in many changes in gene expression, which are collectively called the stringent response. It's actually what mediates the transition from going in from exponential growth to stationary phase. So anything that causes slight starvation can trigger PPGP. There are on the order of 100 genes just involved in amino acid utilization. So any loss of function mutation in those could potentially trigger PPGP. So for those who know about PPGP, This is not that simple.
It's almost like all the deleterious mutations.
Yep, and that's what explains the high frequency, well, not almost all, but many. That explains the high frequency of the resistance. It varies. It varies. Sometimes it's significant fitness cost, and it scales with the level of resistance.
You get much less if you would grow the cells in minimum medium glucose, right?
I don't know. We always do it in ranching glucose. In fact, I suspect if you grow in millimeter, you might get high homogeneous resistance because you're triggering the strenuous response. Right? But I don't know. We don't do that. We've never done it. We know that, at least for MRSA, in our PKPD model, you get heteroresistance. And that's one of the reasons, actually, why we thought you wouldn't get heteroresistance inside a person, because there you're under usually nutrient-limiting conditions, so you might expect high homogeneous resistance. So, yeah, I don't know. But it might depend on the type of infection and the stage of the infection.
Excuse me, but just one very quick thing. So what does amino acid synthesis have to do with cell loss?
Ah, yeah, that we don't know. So we know that the beginning of the pathway, we know that there are all these stressors that trigger PPGP synthesis, and how does that connect to cell wall synthesis? Presumably there's some regulatory cascade, but we haven't mapped it out. We don't know.
You need to make cell wall anyway, right, if you want to grow, so.
We don't know. I don't know.
But you're doing it, so one of the PBPs, this 2A or whatever it is still not functioning, the other ones are. Is that?
In MRSA, this is very complicated because beta-lactams have different binding affinities, but you can think in MRSA that all the essential PDPs are inactivated except PD2A. Now, we also see it in cellulose and E. coli, but it's very complicated, and this is probably explains the ampicillin. It's because different beta-lactams have different binding affinities to different PDPs. So for a given beta-lactam, not all PDPs can be completely inactivated. And it's very, yeah, and that's why you get wildly different MICs for beta lactams.
I guess the PDP2, whatever, is essential. But you're saying the conditions under which it's not essential if you have the PPGPP.
So in MRSA, you need MEC-A. It's necessary but not sufficient. And then you need something else, this factor.
I thought PDP2 was essential in E. coli.
PD2 doesn't even exist in E. coli. MEC-A is specific to the staphylococcus. No,
PDP2 exists.
Yeah, it's been a different thing. It's just completely non-homologous. It's just naming conventions, but it's not the same thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this conversation always gets very complicated after a while because of names. Okay, but I hope you can see why there could be a lot of treatment failures. And I'll just very briefly give the example of a class 1 antiarrhythmatics. I might be completely botching that pronunciation. Are you familiar with the very famous example of a class 1 antiarrhythmatics in medicine? Okay, so between 1960s and 1990s, clinicians used class 1 antiarrhythmatics to prevent heart attacks. So people who were in danger of a heart attack would be administered this drug, and it prevents arrhythmia. And they thought, oh, you know, that will help the patient. That will prevent deaths. It will lower mortality. And they used it. It was used widely. Late 1980s, there was a meta-study amongst many hospitals. And they found that it actually increased mortality by 5%. That increase was not detectable at the level of the hospital. Now, for a clinician who might see 20 patients die of heart attack, a 5% increase is 21. They wouldn't notice it. But it was readily apparent in the meta-study. And given the number of people who suffer from heart disease, it's estimated that the use of the class 1 antiarrhythmatics resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people from 1960 to 1990. It's a very famous example of medicine to illustrate the need for statistical testing beyond the level of a hospital. So you can imagine a similar thing going on with heteroresistance. It's increasing mortality at the level of hospital. Clinicians don't really notice it, but a meta-study will reveal it. Okay, and that's all I'm going to say about that. And then I'm going to move on to the most controversial subject. So during our studies, we have come to wonder if HBLR and persistence are in fact related. Okay? Ostensibly, they're two very different phenomena. Resistance involves growth in the presence of the antibiotic, and it's a heritable trait. Persistence is a stochastic phenomenon that is not heritable. Okay? So initially, people thought they were very unrelated. So we've noticed some striking similarities between what we are finding and what the people studying persistence are finding. So we noticed that partial amino acid starvation causes resistance. People who study persistence know that complete amino acid starvation that results in the cessation of growth causes persistence. We noticed that overproduction of PPGPP causes resistance. It's known that stochastic spikes of PPGPP cause persistence. In MRSA, we found that if you disrupt the protease CLEP-P, you get resistance. We don't understand why. But it's been noted that if you activate CLEP-P, you can abolish persistors. And finally, some of our resistors have mutations in antitoxin, toxin loci. And it's known that activation of these loci can cause persistence, at least in E. coli. And so looking at these similarities, we cannot help but wonder if there is a deep connection. If heterogeneous resistance is persistence hardwired into the genome via mutation and decoupled from the red herring of growth arrest. And I think what I just said is enormously controversial, at least the people who study persistence.
But
and we could
growth arrest also decoupled from all of this.
So let's imagine, so people who study persistence think that persistence, and I hesitate to say this because I stand in front of like one of the leading persistence experts. But I'm going to say it. I'm going to be bold. I'm going to say it. I think the people in your field think that growth arrest is the cause, or the passive effects of growth arrest are the cause of persistence. Now, there.
No, let's rephrase it. That growth arrest is one way to survive antibiotics.
But the you think
efficiently growing cells, that's all.
You think, though, that the growth arrest is the cause, that it's not just cruelty, that it has to occur for the survival to take place. Is that correct?
No. Suboptimal growth.
Both of the evidence that for a certain type of persistence that you can directly see under the microscope, and there are very few like that.
And you see data that said that. You look at cells in the microscope, the ones that survived were the ones that were not growing.
And there is an assumption that the lack of growth, or the passive effects of the lack of growth, are why they survive. Is that accurate?
Yeah, okay. Because, you know, in contrast to the HBLA that you've shown in E. coli, which is very specific to one antibiotic.
We only tested methicillin. It could be many antibiotics. It could be that what you described is very specific to ampicillin. But we're doing a bigger study. But okay. We show it for methicillin.
You should, and it's not for methicillin only, right? This PPGPP connection.
Yeah, I can explain what I think is going on. But there is a community, and I sent to you those papers. There is a community that says that growth arrest is a red herring. There is, right?
No one looked under the microscope. It says
I think the guy at Princeton did. This is why it's very controversial. But I sent you the papers. We should discuss these papers. I don't know. But it might be that the growth arrest is a red herring, and then there's actually an active response that is accompanied with growth arrest, and it is that active response that is the cause of persistence, the cause of survival. And there's that science paper which says, which basically in the abstract says, tolerance, which they mean persistence, is due to an active response and not due to the passive effects of growth arrest. That's the actual sentence in that abstract. And we really need to discuss it, and I'm an ignoramus.
No, of course, it has been shown that there are also active responses that lead to persistence, but not only, also some talk just growth arrest related response also lead to persistence.
Okay.
Maybe
those active responses are what's also going on in heterogeneous beta-lactam resistance. Because with resistance, you don't get growth arrest. You don't get growth arrest. But that's a very controversial topic, and
no, but
I'm
you get growth. You get the reductions in growth rates.
Slightly, but we've shown that alone.
It was a twofold reduction.
No, that was just in one of the experiments. Usually the resistors is 10%.
But if you look at the stuff atoms at Boston, one argues simply that there are a myriad of different combinations on, let's say, some sort of an adaptive landscape.
in response to an antibiotic exposure that can lead to this. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a selectable trait. And the logic behind this is that you would see much higher levels of persistence or, well, treatment failure were these such heavily selected for, or what were this such a heavily selected for trait.
I'm not sure what you're saying. What do you think?
Antibiotics still work. We've been using them for a long time.
So I've been talking, I talked to a lot of clinicians. So treatment failures are quite common. They're actually surprisingly common. However, they usually don't result in death. In most cases, they don't know the cause of the treatment failure. It usually goes unidentified. If HBR is even responsible for 5% of those cases, the absolute numbers worldwide would be huge.
Sure, but it's one of many possible.
Yeah, there are many sources of treatment failure. Right. But even if HBR is responsible for 5% of those cases?
Even 1%.
Yeah, huge number.
You don't have to convince me.
Okay.
But I'm just curious about the definitions and whether we're not engaging in a bit of a semantic argument here as to what is a persister, a tolerant, or a resister due to this HBLR. It becomes a bit of a religious argument of sorts in the academic field, it seems.
So, and there may be a continuum, and I guess that's what I'm kind of arguing, is that they're all might all be related. But one thing that is crucial to my definition of a resistor is that they can grow. They might grow more slowly, but they can grow, and it's a heritable trait. Okay. That's crucial to my definition. But I'm arguing that, so a lot of people will say to you, at least I think a lot of people will say to you, resistors are here, and persisters are here, and they're not related. I'm arguing they are, or they could be. I'm not saying it. I'm raising the possibility. And this is just a summary of findings. And so for this audience, one thing I want to say is no one has modeled this. There's no quantitative modeling of HBR. And so there's a real opportunity for modelers here.
But I guess there's also a real opportunity for the mechanistic method, right? I mean, there's a lot of work and some understanding about the cell wall synthesis and the machinery and so on. And so it seems to me, I mean, it's a clear conjecture which you have here as to what's driving it, and that's something, has anyone been investigating that in this connection of the PPB, GPP?
So the only people who investigate HBR are staphylococci experts.
But never mind HBR, you've got a genotype and you've got a phenotype. And the one ought to be able to investigate the connection.
Can you look at more data? Couldn't you look at the cell wall thickness, structure, and so forth? Yeah. And these?
So you want us to map out the pathway?
Well, we are doing.
We are mapping out the pathway, but it's hard.
And you can grow them up and you can look at them under an electron microscope, right?
Yeah, we are trying many things. Believe me, we've tested 100 genetic constructs.
Life is simple idea that the crowds of the rest is helping you, right? That maybe when you're actively building cell wall, then that's when you get in trouble, and that's when the thing breaks and you spill it down.
You could be right, but let me. So what I can tell you though is that you can slow down growth other ways and you don't get resistance. So it is not just that a reduced growth rate causes resistance. You can slow it down with chloramphenicol. But that's a persister. In our case, it doesn't stop.
Chloramphenicol is not the best way of slowing down growth.
There's a reason why we chose chloramphenicol. So at low concentrations, chloramphenicol is known as a PPGB antagonist. So it's a way to slow down growth without inducing PPGB synthesis. So that's why we chose it.
If you look at those cells, which are disrupted in your pathway and how they grow, right? Do they grow as regularly as the normal ones, or do they like grow in like?
Let me show you the movie. I didn't get a chance to show. Come on. it took a while to get there. Okay, so these are some movies. Maybe that will answer your question.
So this is in.
Explain. Oh, damn it.
In what conditions is this?
I'll explain in a moment. Let me just get to this slide. So in this quadrant, you have wild type MRSA USA 300. with no antibiotic, wild type with antibiotic, resistor with no antibiotic.
This is a resistor in your pathway, you know?
Yes, it's a resistor and this is a resistor with antibiotic. If, by my definition, resistance is what's going on, you would expect all the cells here, here, and here to grow, and these cells to not grow in mice. And so let's just watch the video. Maybe you can see something that I didn't. The cells grow slower. Just a little bit slower. Not much slower.
Not slower.
Okay, so you saw that. This is a similar one for Bacillus subtilis.
But I mean, where are cells dying?
Here. The wild type cells are being inhibited, and in some cases, the lysis is very obvious in the microscope. Here, it's very obvious. They pop. Boom, boom, boom. Here they also pop sometimes. It's like the opposite of persistence. There's just casting death. But you see, they do grow. And here they die. And here they grow really fast.
Okay. So it seems like there's an alternative hypothesis for what's going on, which is that there's some sort of high frequency, either genetic or epigenetic switch that renders them resistant because it changes something about their properties.
A high-frequency genetic switch.
Or any some sort of switch that occurs at high frequency. It renders the cells capable of growing slower and therefore surviving the antibiotic treatment. But it makes them grow so slowly that they need some secondary mutation that affects the production of PPP, a magic spot. And those mutations that you see are secondary things that occur because they help the colonies grow. And I guess the question is, if you think about it that way, do you think there's evidence that rules out that sort of pathway? Because then those mutants are being selected as you're growing, and you get around the problem of the very large target size that Daniel and I are worried about.
Yeah, we actually moved the mutations into wild-type backgrounds, and they're homogeneously resistant.
Right, those mutations, but I guess what I'm saying is those mutations could still make cells resistant, but they could not have been the precipitating event that made cells resistant. But there's something that made cells resistant, then you get mutations that increase the production of magic spot, and as the resistant cells grow up, and so it's sufficient for resistance, but it's not the precipitating event that enabled the cells to survive.
So, just on the spot, I don't know if I have evidence to rule that out, but I don't know why you need to invoke it, because I think the large mutational target space explains everything.
Except it's hard to believe.
For those who know PPGP, it's not hard to believe.
Yeah, but that's
the mutation rate is 10 to the minus 9.
Yeah.
Right? The genome size is 4 times 10 to the 6.
So let me call it half of 10 to the minus 10.
So,
right. Well, I mean,
ten minus nine is on the high end.
Right.
The number that I heard, and I heard it's fairly universal amongst bacteria, and actually, it's interesting. I've been told it's independent of genome size. I don't know if that's right. Is one mutation per genome per 300 replications?
Right. But that's sort of around the 10 to the minus.
It is
9, and so it means if the whole genome were target size for mutation, all 4 million base pairs, the mutation rate is 4 times 10 to the minus 3, right? If every base pair in the genome is a target for mutation, right? Now, you see situations where the frequency of resistant mutations is 10 to the minus 2, but you grind them continuously, and so if you think about the fact you accumulate mutations in each generation, the mutation rate can be as low as 10 to the minus 3, and you still have a frequency of mutants of around 10 to the minus 2, but that's still arguing, you know, with this back of the envelope calculation of the whole genome. Well, every base pair is a target for mutation.
Point to me in this math where I'm wrong. I think it just follows logically. I don't see a mistake here. And that, if it's true, if everything I say is true, it explains.
So if the target size was 10 to the 5th, the mutation rate is 10 to the minus 9, the product of the target size and the mutation rate is 10 to the minus 4.
And you're not 100 generations, you're in 4.
Right?
So do you disagree that 10 to the minus 2 cells will have at least one mutation somewhere in its genome? Do you disagree with that?
Yeah, I think it's more like...
What do you mean, per generation or after?
No, in an extant population grown from a single cell. Which is what is relevant, because that is what we're assessing.
Yeah, I think your calculation is correct. If Drake's number is correct, then everything points to that. This is remarkably constant number in terms of genome, mutations per genome in DNA-based microbes.
But only as you go from viruses to the calculation is fundamentally wrong. Hmm?
The calculation isn't right. I mean, it's within a factor of 10.
It isn't right.
Yeah, within a factor of 10.
I think it is right within a factor of 10. You may discuss this more.
You're saying it's off by at least 10 fold.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. I mean, 10 to the minus 9 times 10 to the 5 is 10 to the minus 4 per generation. You have at most 10, you don't have 100 generations in the growing up, the colony. So you don't get 10 to the minus 2.
So you're saying it might be 10 to the minus 3.
Yeah, but you're observing 10 to the minus 2. So at some point, we'll have to explain that.
Well, we only observe 10 to the minus 2 when you let them go in a stationary phase and they increase 10.
So there's some selection going on at some point.
The stationary phase. But
right, but there could be some selection going on earlier too, and you'll see a higher.
Usually, we observe 10 to the minus 3 at most.
Or you can invite increase mutation frequency in stationary phase, which is what John Roth and other guys argue.
Right. But I don't think the argument really is whether it's 10 to the minus 2 or 3 times 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus.
Which is 10 to the minus 5 is an enormous number for.
But it's not 10 to the minus 9. And in any case, you're probably all wrong.
You said some way of directly detecting or reporting?
Yeah, we've measured it. It's really hard in our system, actually. We have never even showed the acknowledgements, but we have collaborators who are measuring it, and it is elevated. The data is preliminary, and I'm not very, very, I don't want to go too much into it, but, so these show the different categories of the mutations, and so this is the genes involved in PPGP synthesis, and utilization of amino acids, and utilization of other nutrients, and in these categories, it definitely is being overproduced. We don't detect it in these categories, but that may have to do with the fact that we're operating on the limit of quantification.
All right. Okay.